Welcome to Starfleet Universe On Call. I am Paul Franz, owner of Franz Games. I run SWB Online, FedCom Online, and Starfleet Warlord. Just a reminder how to join us. We have talk guests every Thursday starting at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can either call on the phone system dial 605-562-0444. Just follow the directions of the call ID 17702. Or you can participate on the web. Just go to the Talk's website at www.talkshoe.com and search for call ID 17702 or SWB On Call. Or Starfleet Universe On Call, any of those, then you'll find us. And of course, if you want the best online experience, what you want to have is you want to go to twitch.tv. Yes, twitch.tv/SFU On Call, and you will find us there, and you'll be able to join us in that wonderful chat room and just listen in on such a wonderful discussion for that evening or topic, depending upon the night. And of course, if you need to contact me for any reason, my email address is sfuoncall@gmail.com. It's sfuoncall@gmail.com. Also, if you want to follow me on Twitter, X, whatever they call it this week, you can follow me on sfuoncall, or you want to follow my personal account. That's going to be Paul Franz, PAUFRNZ, no T in that. And also, if you want to follow the business account, which you can find out about what's happening on SFU Online, FedCom Online, and Starfleet Warlord, follow Franz Games, FRNZGMES. Again, no T. Don't ask me. And of course, this lovely podcast gets to the podcast available on iTunes and various other feeds around the net. Quick news from ADB this week. Steve Petrick is still working on that wonderful Orion Master Starship book. Also, the found in the online store for this week is the F&E Planetary Operations 2021. It's $24.95. Planetary Operations has more rules for F&E. It is newly improved and updated, having gone through extensive review and discussion during StratCon 2021. All rules questions from ADB Incorporated BBS have been addressed to provide the best experience for every Empire. And there are new rules for combat. That's the rule 300 section. Repairs, that's rule 420 section. Economics, that's 430 through 450 section. And special rules, which is the 500 section. It also includes four scenarios, and that's going to be in the 600 section. Moving on and forward to SFB Online, the Sapphire Star 15 tournament will be starting up very soon. The signups will be available as of this weekend. Moving onward to the online client stuff, we have actually a fix for the general units where they were not launching seeking weapons if you had selected a refit. For that, it would not actually launch like drones or plasma or shuttles, things like that, you know, minor things like that. That is now fixed. Now also, when it comes to the library report, there's minor things happening with the general units. I fixed them, so it will fix it for the current moment for all general units. Well, not all general, but at least the battle station, the base station, the star base. I think that's it. There might be one. I got to check it out if the mobile base has the same issue. And I will fix it. Now, I'm going to be working on those to fix those up a little, to be a little better than they currently are with the refits and all. But in the meantime, those have been updated. There will be some more updates to the Klingon ships on their look and feel. So I got those from Frank. I just have not had a chance to upload them. So with that, that is the news for this week. And it's me, it's the one and only Paul Franz, welcoming you to Starfleet Universe On Call. And tonight, actually, we have quite a crowd. It's awesome. And tonight we have with us Gary. Say hi, Gary.
Hi, Gary.
And we have Jeff here. Hi, Jeff.
Good evening, everyone.
And last and certainly not least, we have Mr. Howard. How are you doing, Doug?
I'm here. How are you guys doing tonight? Thank you.
Good.
Thank you very much.
Better than last week, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, definitely quite a crowd compared to last week, which is always good. More voices,
yeah,
more
last
conversation.
Last week, I was dealing with a broken trailer. 3 shop visits and $1,000 in on-the-road repairs, and they still didn't fix it.
Oh, you gotta be kidding me.
Yeah.
Three different shops over a week, and I still ended up stopping every 3 hours and putting oil in the hub to keep them
seizing up,
keep the bearings happy.
Yeah, you don't. Yeah, no, that would be bad.
No.
Yeah. For love of Pete, guys, there must be a leak going on somewhere. Jeez.
Yeah, it was.
How hard is it to find a leak? Because this is an axle.
One wonders.
Not exactly the simplest of systems.
Oh.
It could be anywhere. It could be anything.
At least I got an attaboy from the last mechanic to work on it that told me that I definitely saved the bearings by continuing to stop and putting oil in it, because when he heard the problems, he was afraid that the wheel seals and the bearing pack had gone the way of the dodo.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that could be a lot worse. Vagarities of transportation industry, that's for sure.
Agreed. Well, someone has to get the products from point A to point B and everywhere in
between.
Yeah,
you know, in order for those fancy starship captains to stay in captain's logs and coffee cups, the freighter guys have to do their job.
That's true. You just got to make sure you don't get any pirates or Orion's stopping you and going, hey, we'd like to have your cargo.
Hey, I'd like to have a cut. Oops, I'm sorry. I said the quiet part out loud. You'll have to bleep that, Paul.
Yeah.
And thank you, Dave, for keeping me up to date on the score. It's 13-7 at halftime. Eagles versus Vikings. And of course, it's that time of year again, folks. It is football. And invariably, Dave likes to report the scores, and every once in a while, I like to report them, even though it's on a podcast. And by the time you hear this, you already know what the end result is of the game. So, and anyhow, it's always a nice little distraction in the middle.
And we certainly need more of those.
Amen. Well, in some cases, I think we have too many distractions. But in other cases, yeah, we need some more. Just the take a chill pill and just, you know, because sometimes I think the world takes itself too seriously.
Yeah.
But anyhow, let's hear from the Nanook of the North. Hey, Gary. You said you had a topic?
Well, three of them, but I think I'll stick with one for now.
Okay.
Although before we proceed, I should note that so in the franchise, there is such a thing as a fleet museum where ships of renown get stored for posterity. Now, if you have a look on Memory Alpha, there's actually a page for it, but the page, I should warn you before anyone goes to it, it's quite spoilery for anyone who is minded to avoid spoilers about season 3 of Star Trek Picard.
Hmm.
So, before we go any further, I just want to get that out there now so that people can fast forward the podcast to whichever point we stop talking about in June. So, is that okay?
Yeah, understood.
All right. So, basically, if you have a look on the VBS, there's a thread in the proposals board about what the Starfleet Universe version of the Starfleet Museum might look like. It includes a link to the article from Memory Alpha, but it also talks about a couple of the ships that thus far at least have been confirmed to be in some sort of museum within Federation space. And then there's a discussion going on in terms of like what the FSU version of the museum should look like and where it should be located and a little bit about like what ship should be in there. So do you want to take a second to have up there?
Yeah. What section will that be in? Is it SFB proposals?
So if you go to, it's under Starfleet Battles.
Mm-hmm.
And then a proposals board, yes.
Okay.
And then under other proposals,
uh-huh.
down in very near the very bottom. It's actually near where the discussions about Thorians in Omega that we are having before.
You mean the Starfleet Museum?
Right below that. That's the one, yes.
Okay. Okay. Got a Zinni with me.
So there's actually a surprising number of quote-unquote hero ships that are in the franchise version of the museum. So I guess for the purpose of comparing and contrasting what should be in the Starfleet Universe version, I don't know if it would be worth bringing up the memory of a page or not.
Yeah. Yeah, I brought it up, actually. Do that. What? That is a screwball. Okay. And you're saying personally, I would guess that the Starfleet Museum has its own dedicated civil base station, plus a maintenance dock capable of servicing at least one museum ship at a time. Which makes sense.
Oh, that's... Yeah. So that's about the one that the Starfleet Universe has. Because basically, my line of thinking was that for the Starfleet Universe version... Actually, before we go into the Starfleet Universe one, should we talk a bit more about what the franchise one is like?
Yeah.
All right. So basically, the franchise one is... as of 2402, is located in some other star system, so it's not in the solar system. And it's based around the old Space Dock 1, which somehow has been transplanted to this new system. So unlike in the SFU, where once you've got the starbase, that's it, they were somehow able to basically tug the old starbase, Space Dock 1, from Earth to this new system. And so the space dock has been converted into the housing area for the museum. So some of the ships are docked internally, and others, what they've done is that they've constructed these ring-shaped observation platforms. So when the ship is docked in the middle of the circle, you, the visitors in the museum, can walk around the circle and look at the ship. So before you actually go on board the ship, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So you could actually walk around the ship while you're out in space.
Correct. So you don't have to be in a spacesuit to get a 360-degree view of the ship. But I guess they do have, like, you know, the ability to go on board them as well, so. Now, there's actually a fairly, as you can see on the list there, there's actually a fair number of quote-unquote hero ships that have been retired to the museum. So it's the NX-01 is there, and the Enterprise A from the movies, and the Enterprise, well, one of them is a big spoiler for Picard in particular, so... Again, well, we've got across that Rubicon, I suppose, but just to triple reiterate, basically the another Enterprise is there, and there's also the Voyager is there, or Voyager, the
of course
one from the TV show Voyager,
right?
And yes, well, because there's a couple other Voyagers after. There's also the Defiant, the second one from Deep Space Nine, so not the one from the. In the Mirror Darkly from Enterprise, or from the original series. And there's actually a Constitution-class ship in there, too. But and if you look at the picture, you can see that it doesn't look like the one from Strange New World. It actually looks, well, you can tell the audience what it looks like.
Mm-hmm. Okay, are you talking about the jersey?
The New Jersey, yes. Now, of course, it's not the same as the New Jersey in the SFU, but no one would expect it to be.
Right.
But it does have a more kind of Starfleet Universe compliant look to it. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Cool. Obviously, folks in the podcast definitely going to want to bring up Memory Alpha fandom or possibly actually watch the video version of the podcast this time. That'd be great help. Got the USS Argo, which yeah. I'm not familiar with that ship. Saber class ship, Federation Starfleet Museum at Anthem, but the early 20th century, it was displayed on the lower ring pick of the Bounty.
Yeah, so there's actually a couple of non-Starfleet ships in there. So there's the Klingon Bird of Prey, which is from the Star Trek IV. And then there's the Katinga class that's from the Undiscovered Country, Kronos one.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a Romulan ship in there too, old Starbird of Prey. Although it looks a bit more like the ones that they've had in other more recent series too. So, but yeah, it's actually interesting to see because when you think about the way in which the Constitution class has been kind of reimagined in both Discovery and in Strange New Worlds,
mm-hmm.
it's good to see that. In New Jersey, in the museum, looks like Matt Jeffrey's design. So it hasn't been entirely, decanonized, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But because I think an interesting way to split the difference could be that maybe in the future they could do an episode of Strange New Worlds where they encounter the New Jersey, and the New Jersey looks the way it does there, even while the Strange New World Enterprise looks the way it looks as it is right now. So it'd be a way to basically say that, you know, both incarnations exist in the franchise still.
Yeah, I like the Strange New Worlds. I like that show.
Mm-hmm. Although I gotta say, I actually think that the Strange New Worlds version of Enterprise would actually look, I would see it more as like a parallel equipped version of the Constitution refit rather than the OG 1701, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you hadn't seen the ship from the motion picture and someone said, here's what a refit Enterprise would look like, you could see the Strange New Worlds ship version, it could work for that, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, agreed. That which is, of course, overall, when you think about it, it's hard to, because this is always the gotcha with this stuff, which is, okay, the original series was created, you know, back in the days before they really had all the CGI and all these nice glass panels and that kind of thing. You know, it was pretty, you know, you're still pretty much physical objects that you controlled. And that was the thought, that was the thinking back in the 60s. Versus today,
mm-hmm.
everything is just a piece of glass that you then modify and control. And
which we saw with the 2009 refit Enterprise.
Exactly. But the problem is, for Strange New Worlds, the UI design supposed to be pre the original series, but it definitely looks post the original series when it comes to look and feel. And Lord knows, when it comes to Star Trek, the original series, One thing that drives me crazy, I've got a copy, a nice yellow container of the whole original series episodes, all of them. One thing that drives me crazy, they did not leave the original hand created, models in space. They made them more modern CGI for the space scenes, which to me just kills it. Because you go back and forth between the backgrounds that are the internals, interior scenes on the Enterprise compared to the exterior scenes of the Enterprise, and they're completely different in the look and feel.
It was like the CGI remaster of the original series. Yeah. And nowadays, if you want to try to buy the original series for home viewing, the CGI remasters are about all you can find. I went looking to try to buy the original series or the animated series recently, and Paramount doesn't allow it to be sold anymore. You can watch it all you want if you subscribe to their monthly subscription service.
Which one? Paramount
Plus? Paramount
Plus. Okay. Yeah, I just canceled mine.
Darn.
Well,
they make the yar out of it. Let's put it that way. For some people. I totally agree with you on that whole thing about like when they remaster all the space scenes and the rest looks like the 1960s sci-fi stuff. It's like, well. Yeah, I think the big problem that you have with the newer stuff is that it's a matter of how it's relevant for everybody today. Because you've got 50 years something plus of technological advance in the real world. When the series was put out and like now.
Not to mention the fact that the series is done on
a shoestring compared to like what they do now for anything. So.
And one of my favorite anecdotes is the original series and the animated series that followed it. The first couple of seasons of Next Generation, not so much. But they all were produced thinking that they would be consumed on a device that only had to preserve 238 lines of resolution. And nowadays we're selling devices that have 2100 plus lines of resolution. It's just a little bit of additional detail fills in the gaps quite well now. And it's one of those things. If you look at the old stuff that's been cleaned up as best as possible without changing it, a lot of people prefer that. The people that go back and, I'm of the opinion that when they did the CGI remaster of the original series, they went right down the middle of, we're going to preserve what the fans love and we're going to make it look good on modern hardware versus let's show them what this should have looked like in the first place, which is giving it the Lucas treatment. Mm. To mention a different fandom, but the thing is that you're absolutely right. The reimagination can sometimes destroy that which you're trying to preserve, and it's one of the more annoying things when you see someone pick up the rights to an old favorite and not treat it the way you wish it would be treated. I think that's a safe way to put it.
Mm-hmm. I was going to mess with my banana splits, will be okay.
There you go.
Yeah, well, that is the biggest issue, especially for those people who grew up watching it. I know we're getting old. I understand that. but there's a bit about it, you know, about remembering the way it was, then trying to make it modern instead of making it a time capsule of the way it looked, and enjoying it for what it was, you know.
Turning around and finding any additional resolution available from old film prints to make a really good HD remaster is like making sure there's no rust and fresh paint on the museum ship. It's important, but there's only so much you can do before you start telling your story over the top of the story everybody came to see.
Mm-hmm. And Lord knows, I'm not sure you remember the Hollywood Fire? You know, where we lost all of those original film. You know,
yeah, that was horrible.
That was horrible. I mean, that's a great loss in our history, right there. Before they could ever be digitized, you know, the high resolution digitization could occur, they're gone. You know, so any of those that were there, it's gone. Those films are gone. You know, in the best case scenario, we'll have lower resolution copies around.
The second or third generation copies rather than duplication masters.
Yep, exactly. But anyhow, getting back to the original topic, which is basically about, okay, this is what the quote unquote historic version is, or basically Paramount's version. Not from Paramount, but from the fan.
Yeah, franchise version.
Yeah, right. Of what the Starfleet Museum would be Lord knows the multiple movies and TV shows and so forth. Which I'm going to bring this up once, and then we're going to move on. Which is, I actually watched the last season of Star Trek: Strange New Worlds. And the one thing that's like, I can't believe they did, was they did a crossover with Lower Decks. The animated series. What? You know, I couldn't believe it. I swear it was purely to introduce anyone who's watching Strange New Worlds. Oh, you know, there's an animated series over here called Lower Decks, I'm sure you'd enjoy. So, anyhow,
got that tie-in. Come on.
Okay, Got that out of my system. So we don't. I won't bring that up again. But okay, now that's for the Gary calls it the franchise, the museum. It's actually it's fandom. It's the fans who created this and. Not Paramount. So.
No, well, it is. No, what I'm saying is that that thing that you see on the Memory Alpha wiki,
right.
Those are actually from Star Trek Picard Season 3, because they went to the Fleet Museum, and the way in which it's presented on Memory Alpha reflects what was shown on screen. So until Season 3 of Picard, there's only been random references to there being a Fleet Museum. But the one that you see on that wiki page is it. Like, it's actually the one that they portray, like, in the television show.
Right.
That's but, something... And actually, it's funny enough you mentioned it, because that episode of Strange New Worlds at Lower Decks, there's actually a plot point that refers to the NX-01 in the Fleet Museum in terms of a way of solving an issue that they have in the episode.
Yes.
So it's funny that you're complaining about that episode, but that episode actually... ties into the whole Fleet Museum concept that we're trying to dig out here. So.
Mm-hmm. I missed that reference. I didn't miss the reference to NX-01, and basically the part of the NX-01 was actually each as they mentioned in this, in that one, which is basically each successive Enterprise, there's a little piece of the original Enterprise in the next one, which was an interesting thought. You know, never heard of that before. But it definitely, that was cool. That was a cool thing.
Although they don't actually keep the NX-01 as it was seen on the TV show, because in the novels they speculated on a refit that would add that would kind of like bolt a secondary hull to the bottom of the ship. And it's that version was actually canonized for the first time in that episode of Picard, because the one that's in the museum has the sticky onion bit that was put on there rather than being the actual OG ship. So not entirely sure how I feel about that, but anyway. But to get back to the Starfleet universe,
right?
There's about three. There's two ships for sure, which are confirmed to be in the Starfleet Museum, and they're both Galactic Survey cruisers, and not coincidentally, they're both named after NASA orbiters that suffer grim fates in the real world, because I believe that ADB have a moratorium on those two ships because they want to pay respect to the real life astronauts whose lives were lost on board those orbiters. So that's why you'll never see a scenario with the Columbia or the Challenger.
Right.
And that's why in the write-up for the Galactic Survey Cruiser history, it specifies that they're both put into the museum afterwards. So they for sure are there. And on top of that, there's a couple of ships that are quote-unquote museum ships, but it's not formally stated that they're in the Starfleet Museum, although I suspect they are. And one of them is actually the Constitution itself, the NCC 1700. So just the same way that the real world floating, you know, wooden Constitution is parked up in Boston and sails around now and then because it's still seaworthy. The NCC
1700, still in commission.
Yep, that's right. The 1700 basically is treated the same way. So it does go out on cruises now and then, but it is birthed in a museum otherwise. So I would just say it's the Starfleet Museum. So, but although it's actually funny, because when you think about the whole idea of museum ships, if all the wood that's in the real-life Constitution, it's probably gone through the whole Ship of Theseus thing quite a few times by now, because there's probably not that much left aboard the current ship that was there 200 years ago or so. Because, you know, the wood rots and it has to be replaced, and metal rusts and it has to be replaced and so forth, whatever. So there's basically the process of maintaining the form and structure and, I guess, spirit of the ship,
right.
Even if the original components have been claimed by history.
Right, so, the only thing that...
Kind of think about it that way.
Yeah, the only thing that could possibly be of 200 years history, I would think, is definitely the cannons. Because they're metal. You know, I would think they would last 200 years. Also, I'm not sure.
Just as an aside on that, you could probably look that up on their website. But I would say that a good bit of that, the wood from that ship, is still probably original. And I mean, like, the interior framework more than anything else. So. It's a possibility that, because it doesn't always just, you know, rot away, so to speak. Who knows? I mean, that's a really good question, and one that is probably going to be only solved by looking that up through the historical preservation information at the ship's, you know, berthing, whatever they have, whoever the Park Service does for it.
And there was actually something similar that happened in Japan with the pre-dreadnought battleship Mikasa, where at some point after the Pacific War, there was another ship similar to it, I think in Peru or somewhere like that, or somewhere. It was being decommissioned itself or being scrapped or whatever. And so crews from the USS Nimitz, there was obviously some American ship, whatever. Basically, they worked together with the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force, or whoever it was who manages the ship, to basically extract hull segments on other components from the South American ship to basically restore the Mikasa, the Japanese one, to a workable standard. But then bear in mind the Mikasa is actually in concrete. It doesn't float in the water, because that was basically one of the terms by which it was assigned a museum ship. And that's basically what saved it at the end of the Second World War too, because it was already a museum ship, so there was no reason to do anything about it other than try to preserve it. What was I getting at? Yeah, so when it comes to the Starfleet universe, so we don't know for sure where the museum is and who runs it and what other kind of ships they have.
Right.
But a few ideas have been posted in the thread.
Mm-hmm.
So I myself, I'm actually kind of interested in the idea of putting it near Callisto, because actually in the real world, there's a number of probes that are going to be heading it. They're either on the way to the Jovian system or they're getting ready to be launched. So, one of them is mainly focused on Ganymede, and NASA's one is going to be focused on Europa. But apparently China's thinking of sending one to Callisto, and they might even drop a lander on the surface. So, Callisto generally has a relatively low, at least on the surface of the moon, it's got a relatively low radiation count. It's only like 0.1 millisieverts, or I keep mixing up grams and millisieverts. Anyway, but basically, it's actually lower than on Mars. So, if you put the Starfleet Marine Museum there, you could park a commando ship on the surface of Callisto, beside like a ground-based marine museum, and the maintenance work for the ship wouldn't be that bad. Like, by the standards that Starfleet ships are built, because they've got much better radiation protection than our craft have.
Mm-hmm.
So, but nonetheless, I mean, it would be a factor. And also, but based on what's in Prime Directive Federation, there are people who live in the vicinity of Jupiter, but it seems that most of them live either around Ganymede or maybe close to Io. So Callisto basically is a relatively blank slate, so you could put the museum there. And another reason why I think Callisto would be an option is as a political compromise, because Earth is already the most powerful planet in the Federation. It's got Starfleet, it's got the Federation Council, the President lives there, it's got the Starfleet Academy, it's got Earth's own National Guard, which is probably the most powerful National Guard. It hogs a lot of stuff. So I imagine that the other member planets, if they're basically trying to say, now hold on a second, Starfleet is not an Earth fleet, it's a Federation fleet, they might basically have to compromise in saying that you can't just have it in Earth orbit. If it has to be in the solar system, it has to be somewhere that's still accessible and still maintainable, but not at Earth or at Mars for that matter, because Mars is also a major Federation planet in the modern Starfleet universe era.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I was thinking that Callisto could be seen as like a compromised option, where it's still securely within the solar system in terms of making sure no one steals the ships, and also in terms of keeping them up and running. But it's just far enough away to be politically acceptable to the other planets.
Mm-hmm. True. I think that'd be an excellent idea. My question is, I'm thinking about one ship that I would think would be great in the museum, which is the USS Hood. I forget the exosaucer section. I know it originally survived. Was it ever destroyed?
It was the saucer. It was the saucer got away, and I think they refitted it later. If I remember correctly.
There are a couple of ships that the secondary hulls were destroyed. Another example is the drone cruiser Agincourt, because its secondary hull was lost, and then a new one was put on. Actually, I should note that this is also a plot point from Star Trek Picard in terms of if you recover a well-known saucer and you take a secondary hull from a different ship, the ship that gets credit is the ship that the saucer was from. So too bad for the ship from the secondary hull ship. But yeah, basically, it would appear that in both universes, the procedure would be to go with the name of the ship that the saucer is. So, I mean, the hood could be put there, or Agincourt, or maybe the Darwin could be put in there, you know, because that ship is due to get decommissioned, or like a White 207 or White 208 or something like that. So by then, maybe, I guess, the circumstances of the Darwin's mission will be declassified because the Andromeda won't be over. And, but I mean, there's already two Galactic Survey cruisers in the museum by then, so would a third one be overkill? But in any case, I actually think that it would be interesting if the museum had at least one ship from every era of warp travel. So you've got an old sublight ship from the First Romulan War, then you've got a warp-refitted ship, you've got an earlier ship. Well, we already know they've got a couple of, like, quote-unquote modern ships. And then maybe an X-ship or something, like, say if there's one of the X-ships from the Andromeda War is doesn't have a long service life left, because some of the X-ships were built using... So you have to build an X-ship using peacetime methods. But any of the ships that were basically peacetime versions of wartime hulls, they don't have the same longevity as a true peacetime ship. So, right. For example, if you look at module X1R, you can build an X-ship that looks like a new heavy cruiser. You can't convert one because the structure is not sound enough on the original NCA to upgrade it. But even if you do that, the resulting NAX, it's a capable ship tactically, but it doesn't have the same operational range as an X-Tech heavy cruiser built on the Constitution framework. So after several years of use, the ship is probably going to get worn out more quickly than the likes of the GSX or any of the X-Tech ships based on peacetime hulls. So it's quite possible that eventually they can put one of them in the museum if there's no more use for it otherwise, especially once the X2 ships come to that, because they'll be the new hotness, and then Starfleet will have to decide how they're going to have a look at the status of the fleet and go from there. So after being drawn in, I should say.
Yeah, I would think that the one thing I would think that might be an issue at all, it would be one obviously the museum would be set up in the 200 year range, you know, Y-200 some time after that, when the second generation ships, seven second generation X ships have been built, and therefore some, you know, the technology, so like, you know, no one would actually fail the Constitution class ship, you know, the actual Constitution, you know, for battle. You know, it might do it for a good peace, a peace tour possibly, because I remember, I'm not sure if y'all remember, I know I do, which is in 1976, the whole big tall ships in Baltimore, and also I think they might have done it also in other cities, which was,
yeah, it was beautiful.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, the Centennial Fleet thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. I think I still have a copy of the Baltimore Sun or the News American, I forget which, having on the front page the, you know, the tall ships, which were beautiful. I don't think I definitely did not get down to the Inner Harbor to go see them, you know, close and personal. I wish I would have, but it was nuts. It was a great big crowd, big surprise. It was a big thing to happen. But anyway, but the reason why I say that is that I'm wondering if from some of the foreign ships, you know, maybe a Klingon ship, a Romulan ship, an important, you know, Klingon ship, but a Romulan ship, or a Gorn ship, or a Tholian ship, that was considered important to to the overall history of the Starfleet universe. You know. And I, at the moment...
Well, that that goes into like what the actual infrastructure of the museum has. So, as you mentioned earlier, I was basically thinking that the museum can't have things that the active duty Starfleet needs. So,
right.
They can't have like a starbase, and they can't have like a production fleet yard, or a slipway. Like a slipway that can build new ships, because Starfleet and also the Federation police and the National Guards and so forth, they need those. So, but however, there are a number of civilian base stations scattered around Federation space that do not show up on the Federation Empire hex map because they're not military bases.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, I was thinking that that would be the largest space-based installation that the museum could have that would not have someone called dibs on it, so to speak. And also, there is such a thing as a maintenance dock where you have a slipway that can't build new ships, but it can help repair and restore the ones that you already have. So one of those in the vicinity of the station, both in orbit of Callisto or whatever, those I think would be, and together with any ground-based installations on the surface of the moon, I personally think would be appropriate in terms of being able to maintain the collection without asking questions in terms of like people trying to, you know, wipe it for use like in the next time warp affair. So that does probably mean that maybe you might have to, like, if you do ever put an X ship into the collection, does that mean that you have to upgrade the base station to X technology in order to keep track, keep have access to the equipment you need to be able to maintain that ship? Or does that ship have to get sent back to Earth or Mars or something to be serviced if a servicing is required? So I guess there's all that kind of stuff going on. But any of the older ship stuff, I think would be manageable with just those two pieces of equipment and whatever's on the surface. So,
I feel like in that situation where you have an X ship, I would think you could have the maintenance facility for an X ship without actually upgrading the base itself to being X base. You know, I think that would definitely could be possible. It's just like the you have some of the older technology that they do that today, where you might build an old, you have some older technology which is used to build an older part which can otherwise could never be built, built to the same specification or built the same way and possibly last the same amount of time. So I think that'd be the same kind of thing. But it's, obviously there's political things would be involved if you ever tried to get non-Federation ships into a Federation. Well, it's considered a quote unquote Federation museum. I would hope at that point in history that the universe would be peaceful enough time where some of the older ships that these empires have, they might be able, maybe willing, to have them in a shared museum, in which case obviously it couldn't be around Sol. It wouldn't be in the Sol system if you'd have other empires kind of volunteering to donate to the museum. If you'd have actually other empires actually donating ship like Kang's flagship or something along those lines.
Well, there'd probably be, I should also point out, there's actually a Vulcan Museum ship from the early years as well, although it's not specified that it's in the Starfleet Museum or elsewhere. So according to the early years material and also the Federation of Master Starship book, the Vulcans built two early years clan cruisers. One of them was destroyed, but the other one was actually, it hosted the negotiations for the treaty that ended the first war of the Klingons. So the Vulcans themselves didn't really care because they thought it was illogical to keep the ship just for that. Mm-hmm. But the other planets on the council basically voted to keep the ship as a museum. Now, I would say that basically the logic of that is that the Vulcans would say, all right, well, it's yours now. So they don't want to have to pay for the upkeep on Vulcan, at Vulcan. So they would basically donate the ship to the Starfleet Museum, and then it would be there as part of the representation of the early years history.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, also one of the important things about the museum is that at the very beginning of warp travel, there was no such thing as a Starfleet in the first place. It was only the member planets. And then when Starfleet was formed, initially its ships were all donated ships from other species, like the saucer and the cell ship didn't appear until like a decade after Starfleet itself was founded. So those ships in themselves are their critical transition points in terms of representing the evolution of Starfleet as an organization. So there's plenty of reason why Starfleet would want that ship, even if it wasn't because of the treaty ship. But yeah, so well, I guess the other thing too would be the maintenance, because it would have like bespoke Vulcan technology on board and so forth that would be different than the standardized technology aboard the saucer and nacelle Starfleet ships, or for that matter, aboard the old Earth ships like the Texas class light cruiser that Starfleet would have an institutional knowledge of.
Right.
So there's probably a couple of exchange officers from the Vulcan National Guard who are seconded to the museum in order to make sure that the other species don't mess up their ship. Technically speaking, Vulcan, the planet, has given up the ship. No, in terms of, like, they probably won't be refuse the money that the museum would pay to hire consultants to make sure that everything is legit, so to speak.
Right.
So basically, if someone else is paying for it, then that's no problem. But so there actually is such a thing as a Starfleet Bureau of History. So in universe, you know how like in the real world, there's like the Naval Academy Press, and there's like all these different institutions that write history books and stuff. So in the Starfleet universe, the Bureau of History actually writes history books, and they turn a profit because they sell it to a civilian market. So if you want like a history of the Andromedan War, or a history of such and such a ship, they're often the ones to write those books, and then the proceeds, I guess, go to them. So I imagine they've probably got an office, if there is a civilian station assigned to where the museum is, they've most likely got several offices there where people who maybe people who want to study those ships, to write the next wave of books, actually have direct access to them.
Mm-hmm.
And there's probably all these like guys who are doing things like so if you think in our world, there's the movies like Master and Commander, and they went and took 3D scans of the constitution in order to create the Acheron from the movie. And so they wanted to try and basically make it as authentic as they could, even though the French didn't actually have a ship of that kind historically. So, because I guess they didn't want the movie to be set in the War of 1812 and have the Americans be the bad guys. But there's a bunch of tri-video recordings there, things that are basically sold in universe as well. So I imagine there's probably a lot of research teams from those big production studios who go to the museum and ask to film aboard ships, or at least to take measurements and take reference notes and so forth, so that if they do their own version of like a show set during XYZ time period, because I guess to them, like a historical drama set during the old Romulan War is probably right. Like us doing a story set during the Battle of Jutland. So there'd be that, you know, demand among the Federation public to see those kind of tri-video programs. So that's probably another way in which the museum makes money, in that they're basically offering an informed source of information, an informed source in terms of, like, being able to act as historical consultants, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Understood. Which, you know, makes sense to a certain degree. When you talk about it, I just think about how the question I have, and this is a philosophical and historical question kind of thing, which is one thing that I'm reminded of is that the Federation is supposed to be this utopian society where, you know, everyone's provided for. You know, obviously, once you can earn money, everyone has credits and so forth. But the question is, how much, where do the credits go? You know, what would you be willing to pay for credits to actually purchase and buy and so forth? Obviously, you're thinking that the historical, basically the Federation Historical Society, I know that's not what you called it, the Bureau of History, I think is what you called it, would be one of those things where, you know, people, you know, that the Bureau would actually invest in the, it's not restoration, but the recording of history, and make sure that history that happened, the history of the universe, you know, I'm assuming that they mainly be focused on the Federation, but they might actually have other agents that actually try to ascertain the history of other empires, you know, without revealing any, you know, trying to reveal any secrets about what happened in the history of, like, the Klingons or the Romulans, you know, the kind of little exposés where, like, the whole what happened, what truly happened on Romulus or Remus, you know, those kind of, you know, clickbaity of titles, you know, which is, you know, the thing about,
well, funny. In the, you bear in mind that if, according to the Prime Directive for RPG, there is still such a thing as money in the Starfleet universe,
right?
Because Prime Directive Federation actually goes into a little bit in terms of, like, how the social system works. But there are still corporations, and, I mean, there's still minerals like dilithium and so forth, whatever that. Well, I mean, dilithium is rare in the franchise, too. But basically, because the other thing, too, is that the Starfleet universe, you can't really rely on things like replication, because, like, if you try to replicate something, for one thing, the way the SFU has it is that you can actually, if you own a replicator, you can actually put it kind of almost like a word mark in the replication.
Right.
So, like, when you produce an object, it's got, like, a stamp to show where you got it and which empire it's from, that sort of thing. But also, replicated objects, the more complicated they get, the more difficult it is to replicate them, and also the more fragile they get. So you can't build, like, a part that needs to be used in a thing. Like, the best thing for replication is, like, maybe, like, a shield from, like, a pre-industrial planet or something. But you can't really replicate, like, a phaser, because the mechanisms are too, like, it just won't function properly.
Right.
So, like, things like starships and other kind of equipment and so forth, they have to be made in order to work. So...
Right, certain parts are too unstable, to, you know,
extract, like, the resources, you know, and refine them further, and have people go to university to learn how to build the parts and so forth. So there's still an economy, so to speak, within the Federation. And of course, each advance of technology changes it, because the chips get faster, the efficiency of the engines gets better, so things are cheaper, ranges of transporters get extended, like for example, like when X technology was first discovered, a lot of the rare minerals that are used for X tech, they were only mined in relatively small numbers because they were only used for very particular industrial applications. Like there was right. no major use for them. Suddenly, you needed a ton of it because you needed to build entire ships out of it. So that's why there was such a big, after the General War, there was such a big uptick in people basically taking work boats and going on survey missions to try to find these things and then build an entirely new industry to be able to extract these new resources and then how to refine them and then how to ship them into the shipyards so that you could actually produce the new X ships in scale. So that itself had a major impact on what the shape of the economy of the various empires looked like. So yeah, it's really interesting in that way, I guess. But and then also when it comes to communications and stuff, because there's different levels at which subspace communications advance, and that not only has a military impact in terms of, like, if you're the admiral at the starbase and you're interfering in your captain's job or stopping them from doing something stupid, but it also has a civilian application, because if you work for, like, Federation news media or whatever like that, you suddenly have a much bigger audience in terms of being able to broadcast, not quite live, but almost live. You'd be able to disseminate information and, you know, watch sports programs or, rally shows. Who knows? Maybe there's like a future version of the British Baking Show or something like that, you know? But, so there's all these different, and also every time a new planet joins the Federation, they've got like a whole vast supply of movies and TV shows or tragedies, you want to call them, and stage plays and so forth. And then every time those come onto the market, they're basically enriching the broader Federation in terms of being able to learn about these things and, you know, incorporate them into pre-existing stories or coin new ones and so forth. So, yeah, there's definitely there's a lot more about the lived inside of the Starfleet universe that could be expanded upon. Mm-hmm. So, because hopefully the museum would actually be a factor in terms of helping to kind of shape some of that anyway, as it pertains to Starfleet.
Still there?
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's...
Oh, okay.
I was reading the last. I was reading the last post.
Just to keep dead silent.
On the Starfleet Museum, which was Jeff Weil. Yeah, Jeff Weil. This talking about transporter relays and how to set up the museum and all that kind of thing. Which is,
I don't know if how much of a thing transporter relays are outside of the Vin Nebula and Omega, because the Rins have a pervasive network that basically stretches from one side of the nebula to the other. So on the inside, I should say. So you can literally beam yourself from one planet in their space all the way to the other in blink of an eye. And for example, their ships, they actually have a transporter link box on them. So for example, if there's a crew member who's on leave on the other side of the nebula and your ship needs to be brought to active duty, he basically beams himself through the network and then walks aboard your ship using the transporter link. And so there's all these kind of things and so forth. But for non-Rin empires, transporters have a much shorter range, but there doesn't seem to be anything I've seen, at least that I've seen in the rules, that say that you can create such a thing as a repeater station. Or even if you have like daisy chain ships, it's not clear as to like, if you have ship A to B to C, do you have to fully materialize the person on ship B and then wait a minute before you beam them to the next ship? Or is there some sort of safety issue? Like, does that increase the risk of turning the crew member into goo? So I don't know whether or not it actually is practical to rely on transporters in that way. I think you might need to still get aboard a shuttlecraft and or board a freighter line or something like that, and have it take you to wherever else in the solar system you need to go, even if it's like a moon of a planet that you're on.
Mm-hmm. And there's really experts, because we don't know or have any idea of how much data that actually is, because basically it's sending a signal with and then that signal is a digitized version of ourselves or of a person. And then they're reconstituted at the other end. Then the question that is, how much data does that take, you know, to do that? Because they're transferring, basically doing a certain, basically a dump from one computer system to another computer system. It comes down to it. You know, there's definitely certain, in my mind, certain technical issues that are hand wavy at the moment when it comes to transport, which is the whole idea of transporting to a location that doesn't have another transporter to receive that information. Because right, the whole idea is that when you transport down, you're sending a beam down, and then you're reconstituting remotely to that location is what you're doing. And same for when it comes to transporting up, you're basically scanning the person remotely to then take their material essence and transforming that into energy and bringing it onto the ship, you know. So it's like, I have some issues with that.
Well, in Prime Directive, there is a die roll modifier. If you're beaming between two transporter pads, relative to beaming to or from, actually beaming to like a location that doesn't have one, so
right.
Presumably any kind of surface facility would have its own transporter facilities and pad and so forth, like for accepting tourists or whatever like that. So, I guess that actually raises the question: is how far in orbit of say, for example, if the museum was at Callisto, how many hexes away from Callisto would the ships be? Like 5 or 10 or 15, or the actual base station for that matter?
Mm-hmm.
Like, would the base station have to be only a certain number of hexes away so that there could be an emergency transport to the surface? Or would it be, you know, yeah, so you have to figure out in terms of how accessible these things are. But bear in mind that each hex is 10,000 kilometers across, so that's still plenty of space to put ships if you're not really mm-hmm. using them on the regular.
Oh, agreed. So, agreed.
As long as there's not a lot of flight pathy stuff going on to get in the way.
Yeah, agreed. And there's probably, if you had a starbase which is going to be orbiting the planet, you want it to be within transportation range in the case of emergency, where people can actually escape, assuming that there's actual a place that people could actually, you know, because I'm not sure what the atmosphere of Callisto is. I'm assuming it's not breathable.
Everyone living there would have to have like some sort of either domed facility or like an underground thing set up. So, I mean, if you're in a spacesuit, you can walk on the surface and
right.
radiation levels are not that bad. But you'd still need to be like in a dome or in an underground facility to actually live.
Right. Which is, you know.
Well, there might be an underwater ocean underneath the coastal surface, because they reckon that there's actually quite a few of the larger moons in the outer solar system that might have at least some sort of ocean underneath it. So
mm-hmm.
that might basically help with the habitability in terms of as long as there aren't any pre-existing life forms, that there's a risk of contamination either way. So if the water is relatively inert, then like any colonists like in the Starfleet universe who are living on Callisto, they'd be able to maybe draw from that if they need to, as long as there's like, you know, the some sort of water processing plant that's required or whatever. So maybe there's like a, you know, the way there's like Fiji water and there's like water from a spring. Maybe in the future they'll be like, here's Callisto water, or you know, all this kind of like.
Talk about the most expensive water in the universe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Why am I paying extra for this water from Jupiter? Yeah, from Jupiter's moons. But, or Enceladus water, you know? They could just, like, get someone, like, to stand in their spacesuit and hold, like, a giant cup over and just wait for the next plume to come out. And then they'll just, like, watch the water go into the thing and then, like, oh, yeah. But that might be more of a Futurama version of Enceladus, though. So the final thing for now, because we're getting late, is I should note that there are other possibilities that people are posting in the thread. So I don't want to claim that I got the answers, because ADB are the ones who want the answers, if ever. But one other proposal in the thread was to basically turn over one of the outer pods at Earth's starbase and have it exclusively be for the museum. And then basically any ships that aren't in there, have them docked externally to the starbase, and then basically just have it at Earth regardless. So I don't necessarily think that Starfleet would want to turn over so much active duty space to the museum there.
Right.
And so I don't know whether it would be practical, but I guess there's different ways that things can be practical or impractical. So,
right. And
if there are people that think that this or some other way is better, then they're welcome to join the talk on the DBS and add their, you know, set view.
Agreed.
Mm-hmm.
Give me a little more light.
But I guess the key thing is to make sure that it doesn't look too franchisey, because you don't want Paramount. I mean, even though the concept of a museum, the Soviet Museum, was committed to print a long time before Star Trek Picard Season 3 was aired, nonetheless, it's always wrong to avoid the impression that you're duplicating what the franchise did.
The franchise is going to be that uptight about idea of a museum, they gotta get a life, because that's a generic idea. In my mind, that's a generic idea. We have the Hall of Fame, you know, which is a historical museum. We've got the whole, you know, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We've got all these kind of, we've got the American Museum, which is just for about American art. You've got the Space Museum, but the previous, you know, adventures of, you know, of our astronauts and the whole idea of space itself. The idea of having a museum to the past of the past history is normal. It's part of every, you know, of it's not a unique idea that they can say, oh, we have
what I'm saying. Well,
now the only issue would be, obviously, if we use IP itself to, you know, in that category, then we might have a problem. But I don't think the whole idea of a museum, they should be able to get upset about that.
I meant more in the sense that it can't be seen as being directly cribbed from the way the Star Trek Picard showed the franchise museum.
Right. Well,
so for example,
well, it comes to look and feel.
We can't have, even though there are ships named Enterprise. Like, there are ships named Enterprise in the FFU, but we're never going to see them, so we're probably not going to have one of those in the franchise museum. And also, that's also another reason why I'd be wary of using a starbase, because the franchise museum has a big space dock, and if you use a Starfleet Universe franchise, that's closer in spirit, if that makes sense, because having a smaller space station with a construction dock, there's much more conceptually a gap from that compared to what the franchise is doing.
Yeah, but as long as we can use the Starbase, as long as our Starbase doesn't look like theirs, we're fine. And the way Starbases look like in the Star Trek universe are definitely different from the Starfleet universe. They look two different ways. So we're not copying their IP. The idea of a museum, maybe, but I don't think you can copyright or have the IP based on the idea of having a museum.
So. No, for the love of God, no. No, if they're upset about anything, it's the fact that they're just not able to do that and that they can't make money off of your idea. But that's essentially what that comes down to.
True. Agreed. Okay, well, I got to shut things up so I can go to bed.
All right. Hey, before you do that, though, after you're done with the show, I want to talk for like 2 minutes.
Okay, we'll do. Oops, somehow Jeff
got a question for you.
Sorry, Jeff, you got muted. I assume you got. Hey, Jeff.
Oh, it happens.
Yeah,
it happens every time I drop.
Yeah, and I wasn't paying attention to what was happening in the actual talk too. So, I apologize if you wanted to say anything during all of our talking.
Yeah, it's okay. You know, about 40 minutes of silence kibitzing. I mean, hey, it's about like, you know, family dinners, you know, for Thanksgiving.
Understood. Well, gentlemen, it's always a pleasure. Gary, always great having you around. You have a good night.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Jeff, keep on trucking. Stay safe out there. You know, keep everything oiled up.
I'll do that. Good night, everybody.
Good night. Doug, it's always fun having you around. You have a good night.
Thanks.
So, had a nice little topic on the idea of a Starfleet Universe Museum, on the past history of the Starfleet Universe and what shipped. Obviously, we didn't get too deep into other ships because I would love. I think some of the ideas for some of the other empires would have been interesting. Unfortunately, I don't know that many, and obviously the whole idea of this would be it'd be a ship that survived, you know, the war. That might be, and obviously, as I mentioned, as part of it, that if you'd want to have it so that it was a museum for all empires, then obviously it had to be moved. It could probably still be in Federation space, but it just couldn't be next to Seoul. It had to be someplace that could easily be traveled by any of the citizens of those empires. You know, of course, some empires are probably more open than others. And, you know, the other empires would have to be willing to donate to it if it was going to be a general one, one for the general SFU universe of history, you know, and those historical ships that really shaped the universe and history, shaped history. So anyway, with that, I am Paul Franz, and I bid you a good night.